This episode is sponsored by Xcel Energy. Xcel Energy is dedicated to providing 100% carbon-free energy by 2050, but they can't do it alone. They need your help. Join Xcel Energy and you'll find a purpose-driven career, solid job security, and challenging work. Xcel Energy knows the value your military service brings to the workplace. It's an exciting time to be in the energy industry. Whether you're on active duty, transitioning, or already embarking on your civilian career, learn about the opportunities with one of America's leading utilities, Xcel Energy, at xcelenergy.com/military. Welcome back to Beyond the Uniform. I'm Justin Asiri, and my goal is to challenge and support members of the military community to reach their peak potential in their civilian career. Today's episode number 335, Emotional Intelligence 2.0 with Dr. Jean Greaves.
There's such a role in the negative self-talk that occurs inside our minds. And I'll give you last one example. For someone who's working overseas and they're calling home and they don't reach their girlfriend or their boyfriend or their spouse, their negative self-talk might say, you know, who are they with? Or, you know, why aren't they there for me? And then the worry starts to kind of create a distance, when in fact your self-talk could be replaced with something along the lines of, yeah, they may be at the grocery store. I think when I finally circle back in with them, I'll ask, hey, you know, where were you, right? So be attuned to what thoughts are going through your mind and how that contributes to your sense.
We received a positive response to episode number 320, Emotional Intelligence with Carrie Meyer, and wanted to go deeper on the topic of emotional intelligence. Today's guest, Dr. Jean Greaves, wrote the best-selling book, Emotional Intelligence 2.0, and created Talent Smart, an assessment taken by over 1.5 million individuals, and which also provides product and services used by 75% of all Fortune 500 companies. To say that she is an expert on emotional intelligence would be a gross understatement. For this episode, we assume that you have listened to episode number 320, which provides a primer on emotional intelligence. So if you have not listened to that episode, make sure you do. If you have, then strap in for a deep dive on emotional intelligence, which is an absolutely essential skill set to hone for every professional, but as we'll talk about today, especially for military veterans. As always, at beyonduniform.org, you'll find show notes with links to everything we discuss on this episode. There's a few attachments that Dr. Jean Greaves has provided as well that you can download there as well. Special thanks to all of you who have left positive reviews on iTunes, calling out in particular CC Walters, who wrote recently, "I'm so thankful I found this podcast. The content is incredible and the stories keep me engaged without ever getting distracted. Thank you for the awesome resource you've created for veterans," Cal Waters. Thank you, Cal, and thank you all of you who have written those reviews on iTunes. It helps us get the word out. So with that, let's dive in to my conversation with Dr. Jean Greaves. Joining me today in San Diego, California, my guest today is Dr. Jean Greaves. Jean, welcome to Beyond the Uniform.
Thank you, and hello to everyone listening.
For listeners, I want to give a quick bio and then a quick disclaimer. So Jean is the CEO of Talent Smart. It is the premier provider of emotional intelligence training products and services used by over 75% of all Fortune 500 companies. She is also the best-selling author of the book Emotional Intelligence 2.0 and is also a presenter and executive coach in the emotional intelligence assessment and training coaching industries. She is skilled in executive development, coaching, and psychological assessment. She holds a PhD focused on industrial and organizational psychology from California School of Professional Psychology and has a BA from Stanford University. She serves as board chair for Survivors of Torture International. Before I give the quick disclaimer, Jean, anything to add or amend from that bio?
Oh, well, maybe I should share that we've been doing this work since the late 90s, really began to focus on emotional intelligence specifically since 2002. And at this point over the years, we've enjoyed many long-term relationships with parts of our military organizations. So I'm happy to be talking with service people worldwide.
That's great. And that leads into the disclaimer, which is back in episode 320, I spoke with Carrie Meyer. The episode was titled Emotional Intelligence. That episode got a really good response and we wanted to go deeper. And so in order to facilitate a deeper discussion, if you haven't listened to episode 320, please pause this one. Go listen to that one. It's a good primer. It gives you the basics in emotional intelligence. But given Jean's expertise, given the 1.5 million people who've taken her assessment, she has a tremendous body of knowledge. I'd love to use the conversation to go a little bit deeper. So if you are new to emotional intelligence, please check that out. It'll give you some good background prior to this deeper dive. So maybe to set the stage, Jean, could you just share a little bit about what led you to start Talent Smart and to write the book Emotional Intelligence 2.0?
Certainly. In the late 90s, that's when this concept really came forward to the world. And it's as a result of work being done on people's brains with MRIs. So there was an intersection between knowledge coming out of the world of medical research, as well as soft skill learning in the world of the workplace. So for the very first time, people had their biological connection to why soft skills matter. And one of the things that drove that is that the MRIs clearly indicate that by the time you've ever thought about a feeling, the feeling has already traveled within your body. So we only have access to five senses. And in most knowledge worker positions, you're relying mostly on seeing and hearing. And it's the part of the brain called the limbic system that processes these emotions. So we don't have the luxury of leaving our feelings at home when we go to work, or even when we interact with our families, going off to school every day. So back in the 90s, we had the first opportunity to bring this knowledge to our clients. And immediately, organizations approached us and said, we really want to work with your leadership assessments because it has emotional intelligence in it. And that was the first time it occurred to us to make these available to people outside, say, the San Diego area where we were working regionally. And by the time we wrote Emotional Intelligence 2.0 in 2009, the impetus for that book came from people interacting with us in the industry saying to us, yeah, we know now about emotional intelligence. We know it's important, but just tell me what to do. If I were already good at it, I wouldn't need more knowledge about it. So we had the luxury of having been in the business of assessing people and training people for over 7 years by that time across the US and internationally. And we were able to collect data and identify what differentiates somebody who has a high emotional intelligence and what somebody who has a low emotional intelligence is doing and saying on the job. So maybe we'll briefly define it as being someone who can recognize what's happening to you in the moment and being able to do something productive with that knowledge and being able to interact with people, read what's happening to them and be able to interact with them and build, deepen, or repair relationships over time. So we put all of that in the book, Emotional Intelligence 2.0, but decided not to make it a chapter book. We thought most people have read a chapter. Here's what it is. Let me share with you a story. Let me go to the next chapter and tell you another story. People were like, no, please tell us exactly what to do. Mm-hmm. So we divided our database into categories of comments from coworkers and supervisors and peers and family members who outlined specifically, here's what you say and do when you're operating with a high emotional intelligence. So we grabbed all the people with scores 90 or above, and then we grabbed all the people that were scoring below 50 on a 100-point scale. And we were able to identify specific strategies that they use day in, day out. So we decided this is more valuable to the world than to only bring to bear our knowledge from the research. So we made a little combination of descriptions from people who are out there living and breathing emotional intelligence on a day-to-day basis, as well as what we know in the research. And that book lists those 66 strategies.
I love that. And correct me if I'm wrong on this, but one of the powerful things when you had said at the start about the MRI, what I heard you say was that the emotion occurs and then the thought. It is the precursor to the thought. And so it almost seems like the emotion is the foundational element of what is occurring in any interaction. Like, we may have a thought or a story that we create in reaction to whatever that feeling is, but if you're able to understand your own feelings or interpret the feelings of others, you're really bypassing a lot of the what is said. Like, you're really getting to the heart of the matter. You're going much deeper than just what might be said or the thought that's occurring. Is that fair to say?
Yes. Now think about what the purpose of a feeling or an emotion is. It's really a signal. Right? It's a piece of data on a biological level that's trying to grab your attention. So, mm-hmm. You know, thousands of years ago, this was our way of recognizing danger, right? So there's a cue in the environment that tells you you must run, or you hear a baby cry and you're going to go and, reassure and cuddle it. This increases our chances of survival. So fast forward to the modern day world, our emotional systems work the very same way. We don't change a whole lot over 100 years here or 100 years there. And so these emotions are surfacing to try to grab our attention. And we live in a world that sometimes says, put your emotions aside or ignore them. But an emotionally intelligent person is attuning to them and getting familiar with their patterns and doing things and saying things that are constructive on a day-to-day basis.
Do you make any distinction or find a distinction between what's going on at an emotional level and what people might call like their intuition or gut feel? Because as you're saying that, I'm like, oh yeah, like your emotion is some sort of signal. Like, how does that play in with one's intuition or what they might call their gut feel?
Well, gut feelings play a role, but interestingly enough, in certain situations, they can steer us wrong. And one way that can happen is, let's talk about hiring situations. If we do EQ work with organizations on the end of screening someone, we have to share with them to be careful about falling prey to a bias of, I want to hire someone who reminds me of myself, right? Mm-hmm. So your gut feeling is, oh, I really liked them, but we teach them social awareness skills to begin gathering evidence that would prove to be, here are the avenues or the situations where they may not operate in a similar way. Or vice versa, if someone is coming across as very different than yourself, you want to be able to gather data and make sure your intuition is coming to the right conclusions. So I believe intuition plays an important role at the beginning, but as you interact with people, you have to attune to additional pieces of evidence. Another way this plays in working professional situations is that we all don't feel feelings in the exact same way. So I might get angry in a really loud outburst type of way, but maybe you get angry by shutting down and getting really quiet. So if I'm walking the halls and you're avoiding me or in a meeting, you suddenly get quiet. If I've learned to attune to what your patterns are, I might notice, oh, well, perhaps Justin is kind of upset. I better go circle back around and check in with him. But if I were using my own measuring stick, I probably wouldn't even notice.
That's interesting. I was thinking of, I just read Talking with Strangers by Malcolm Gladwell. And I think he has a chapter in that where he shows culturally how we interpret emotions very differently. And I think it's interesting that you say that, like, I may interpret what you're doing as anger and it might not be, or some people just display that. And I like your first piece about hiring, because it sounds like it's almost noticing that intuition can sometimes lead you wrong. So building in some structure to offset that, structure through maybe the questions you ask or the information you gather to avoid those natural biases that might not lead to the most beneficial hire or outcome.
Right. And if you're thinking about this from the perspective of a candidate, if you're interviewing for a job and you feel as though the interviewer is leading you down a path and you're thinking, wait, that's not really me. Candidates often don't realize they have the freedom and opportunity to say, can we circle back to a question you asked me earlier? Because I had a thought that I wanted to make sure I could share. Mm. And candidates don't think they have permission to do that. But you can speak up and just double check and circle back around. And usually interviewers are quite interested in that.
That's great. So you're saying if I'm interviewing for a job and I get the sense that the hiring manager is viewing me a certain way, or maybe I didn't explain something well, and I maybe presented myself in a way where I might be viewed as a dictatorial manager, or I might be viewed as cold or insensitive, or I might be viewed as a workaholic, to just kind of take a little bit of autonomy and say, like, hey, let me reflect on that and add a little bit more information that shows that I'm not a dictatorial manager, that I'm not insensitive, or maybe add that missing piece to make sure they're viewing me accurately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and to be able to pull that off, the interviewee has to be not only speaking about their experience, but attending to what's occurring in the moment during the interview. And yep, that's a good example of social awareness skills in action.
If I'm understanding this correctly, it's almost like I need to have the ability to understand what's going on in me. I need to understand, be able to read the cues of what might be going on in that other person. And then I have to be able to bridge that gap between us. It seems like that's a lot going on in one situation. Like it speaks to becoming better at this sort of work.
Yes. And I think you've nailed what makes emotional intelligence a very sophisticated set of skills. It's not a lot of different things that you have to work on. It's simply four skill sets. It's being self-aware, being able to self-manage, being socially aware, and being able to manage relationships. Those four skill sets. But because humans are so unique, as I mentioned, you're tuning to what's occurring internally and surfacing in your mind and your body, whether your heart's racing during an interview would be a good example of coming across nervous. But typically an interviewer might be aware of that. You just don't want them to conclude that, you were so nervous, perhaps you're not very experienced or coming to the wrong conclusion. Mm-hmm. So the sophisticated nature of this and what makes it a lifelong journey is you may be able to master these four skills in one setting, but now you think, okay, now I want to see if I can build this skill set in, say, a negotiation situation, mm-hmm. or how about dealing with conflict with my teenage daughter, or, so it's how to apply these in all these different types of important scenarios.
That's really fascinating, because I know some of our listeners are 15 years into a military career. Whether they realize it or not, they have likely built up a fair amount of emotional intelligence of leading people in a military setting. And that's great. That will serve them well. But then to realize in a different environment, they're going to have to augment that core skill set. There will be different nuances, and the way that they read people or the way that they were read is likely to be dramatically different in a different setting. And to understand like that learning process never ends.
Right. One important thing to keep in mind is emotional intelligence is not an inborn trait. Hmm. That's really different than, say, for example, when people refer to this term, your personality style, right? Someone might come across as a very intense person, or this person is a bull in a china shop, is how someone might be referred to. But personality-wise, it's not going to change over the course of their lifetime. how are you making the most of your personality style? That leader who is a bull in a china shop can begin to fine tune that leadership style such that that presence becomes a strength and an asset rather than something that gets in other people's way or distracts them from, say, what this leader is attempting to accomplish on a day-to-day basis. And maybe this is where I could share one of the insights that we have here at Talent Smart that the world may not be aware of, is now that there have been research studies going on for close to two decades now, one of the strongest repeated findings in published research studies is what's called leader-follower contagion, mm-hmm. is that our emotions are catchy. So if you think you can come into work being distracted based on something that's going on outside of work and potentially hide it, or go from a really difficult, stressful phone call right into another meeting and have nobody pick up on it, it's likely that people are. They're absorbing some type of emotional contagion, and people who are highly emotionally intelligent are able to make sure that that doesn't become destructive and create a negative mood for others and distract them from being able to do their work.
That's wonderful. I love that because I'm a big believer that there, you know, we talk about work-life balance, and there is no fine distinction between the two. These things bleed over. And so it sounds like, you know, one of the assets of becoming better at this work as a leader is that you can help untangle those things, that as someone has things going on, and we all do that, we all have things going on in our lives that keeps us from contributing at our optimal level. And you can kind of untangle that and help the team perform better despite all of these outside influences and other things going on. And it also seems like a much more realistic environment to work in, where it's not this sterile environment where everyone's 100% focused on work. It's recognizing people have a lot going on and meeting them where they're at and helping them be part of the team to the best of their ability in that moment.
Yes, one of the key things about the term emotional intelligence that can be confusing is it almost sounds as though the term suggests that you need to be smart about emotions, so box them up and put them away because they need to not have any influence. Or someone might wrongly conclude they're so important, you need to allow your emotions to drive everything. And that's truly not the definition of emotional intelligence. Emotional intelligence is being skilled enough to know when to tune in and when to self-contain. So it's having that wherewithal and presence in the moment saying, yes, let me mention to the team that I'm distracted based on something else that's going on. That way they can interpret how I'm interacting with them as I'm not angry with them. You know, mm-hmm. in my coaching work, I'll often hear from staff or coworkers that I'm going to be coaching their leader, and they'll share with me that, you know, it seems as though when he's in the elevator, he doesn't acknowledge me. So my conclusion is he doesn't like me, right? So the unknown is always worse than the known. And that leader rarely even is aware that that's the conclusion people are coming to, simply because they were so distracted they're not smiling at others or looking at them in the hallways. So this leader-follower contagion has the element of volume as well. So peer-to-peer interactions are one thing, but we feel the emotions of the leaders we report to at a higher volume. Mm-hmm. That places accountability squarely on the leader's shoulders for tuning into that and helping people understand what their patterns are.
That's so interesting, because when you say that, it makes me realize that as a leader, as a manager, the almost obligation, ethical obligation to become versed in emotional intelligence, because our emotions, they are amplified. They do affect the people that we lead. And so the kind of the burden to be better at, like you said, when to contain, when to share. It made me think, this is years ago, but I had broken up with a girlfriend. I was interacting with one of my sales team members and I just blew up. And you know, he had interpreted that obviously as like that he had done something wrong or his performance wasn't good or his job was in jeopardy. And I thankfully, you know, shared with him like, oh yeah, I just literally broke up with a relationship. That's what's going on. And it just kind of changed, obviously, the nature of the relationship. But had I not shared that, I could see how he would have internalized that. It would have affected his performance. He would have thought it was something he did wrong or that I was awful manager or whatever else it was. And that's what came up for me when you said that.
Yeah, that's a really nice reference to a strategy called using a fix-it statement to a broken conversation. And when you're upset and you blow up at someone, that isn't always the moment that you can catch yourself. So even in that scenario, which sounds like you caught yourself right away and comment on it. So that was a great thing to do in the moment. But had you realized later, the next morning, you can still always circle back around to the person that you accidentally brushed off or, you know, blew up at and say, you know, I was thinking about our conversation and I think that I got really worked up over something that I wouldn't normally get that worked up over because of these other things happening. You know, in a way, you can offer an instruction manual to people as you move through your work day or your work week or your calendar year. And imagine the person receiving that, they would just feel such a sigh of relief. Like, okay, good. It wasn't me. Because when someone blows up at you, you viscerally absorb it. It's an unsettling experience to be at the front end of someone's strong emotion.
Mm-hmm. And I realize the cost too. Like when I've been on the other side, that my experience is that 3-minute interaction that lingers for days. Like certainly immediately afterwards, I'm not present on a call with the client or I'm not present on whatever I'm working on. Like it's really, if you're even just looking at this from an efficiency standpoint to realize someone had once told me that in a relation, I don't know if this is true or not, but in a relationship, 1 minute of arguing takes 9 minutes to repair. And it just kind of planted the seed of like, it's, when we have these disruptions, the impact goes on for so much longer and it takes a lot of effort to overcome that. So I love what you're saying from even just an efficiency standpoint, let alone being a good person and good human being in the office.
Right. I think these emotions that people experience, like a negative emotion, let's name a couple and take the power out of them. Mm. One example would be when you think, oh, I hate interacting with that person because they get so defensive, right? So what is the word defensive? We've all felt defensive about something. It means that you're defending something, something that's important to you. It might be your pride, or it might be your the budget for your staff that you just found out is going to be cut, you know, by 30%. So when we encounter someone who's feeling defensive in a meeting or in a conversation, now you can know, oh, maybe I can find out what it is they're defending. And it is just their feeling. I don't have to absorb it. So maybe that's not so scary anymore. When I find somebody, you know, that suddenly gets defensive, maybe I should just stop and say, oh, wow, this must be really important to you. You know, what is it about this that makes it that's that key? I want to learn more. Now suddenly you're not running away from someone or avoiding them because they're defensive. You're trying to get past their defense. So that's guarding, right? The other one would be this anger or frustration is sort of a mild form of anger. Well, when someone feels frustrated, they start to kind of bubble up and you almost think, are they going to blow? Well, frustration is someone probably trying to get to a goal, but there's something in the way of the goal. So now they're frustrated and they're going to try to get past it. Now it's not so scary.
I love that. I love that because the words have so much power behind them. And when we say they're defensive, it's definitely a judgment that then changes how we interact with them. And I'm guessing that judgment prohibits curiosity of learning what they're defensive about versus understanding like, okay, there's something they're defending. Let me get curious and understand what that is. It makes me think of a guy that I worked with was we were at odds over a client contract that we were trying to sign. And immediately after that, we were doing this communication training similar to what you're describing. And in that, thankfully, we discovered that, you know, he was defensive because he wanted to close the deal. He was commissioned and his team was commissioned based off of closing the deal. And I was defensive because I was really concerned about retaining clients and making them happy. And I didn't want to overpromise things. And as we both started to understand what we were being defensive about, we were able to understand, okay, we both want the company to succeed. We're just coming at this from different angles, and we could kind of figure out where to go from there. But it seemed like a situation where we were both really defending our stake in this matter very differently, and could have been at odds with each other rather than collaborating.
Right. When we don't name or understand the emotions at play, the emotions start to take over the room. And they almost begin to then sort of arrive in advance of when we do and become the force that tells people whether they want to interact with us or avoid us or work around mm-hmm. us or with us.
Yep, that's mm-hmm. great. And you mentioned, I forgot what you had said, but you had said you had given an example of when I gave the example with the ex-girlfriend, the breakup type thing.
Yes.
You had, what did you call that? Like the repair?
It's called a fix-it statement.
Okay. So the fix-it statement
is... And it comes from the work of a gentleman named Gottman, G-O-T-T-M-A-N.
John Gottman, yep.
Uh-huh.
Yep.
And a fix-it statement can be used to repair a conversation or repair a difficult moment in an argument with someone. And another example of what one sounds like, let's just say everything's at an impasse and it just sort of stops and it's a tense moment. A fix-it statement can sound like this: well, I don't have the solution, but I know we've tackled tough things before. I believe we'll get there, right? Mm-hmm. So there's one person who's dropping a little bit of hope into the conversation. And again, it can viscerally create just such a relief on the part of the other person, because those moments are scary. It can create a, wait, are we breaking up? Or is this work relationship over? Is this contract got no way of you know, finding a way forward? It's just this, and anyone can do it. It doesn't have to be the team leader. It can be just someone in the room who comments.
Is that, you had mentioned earlier, an emotional intelligence 2.0, it was over 70 different strategies. Is that an example, this kind of fix it statement and then that incredible soundbite that you just gave us? Is that kind of an example of the content that you cover in the book?
Yes. So as I mentioned, emotional intelligence, these four core skills, this book has, and it's funny, we ended up with 66 strategies, and you might ask, why wasn't it 50 or 70 or even 65? It ended up being 66 because we identified which types of behaviors people with high scores were utilizing over and over. It just kept coming up in our data. And if we knew it also was supported in the research, it made it into the book. So for self-awareness, there are something like 15 key strategies for becoming more self-aware, if that's the area that you struggle with most. And a fix-it statement is part of the relationship management strategies in the book. Yeah.
That's great. I'm imagining a lot of listeners, you know, with a military and veteran audience that loves structure. I think that the structure you're providing there is great. And I just really appreciated that soundbite you had. You know, I don't have the solution. I know we've tackled things like this before. I think that's incredible. That's like such a great sentence to have in your toolkit to be able, in those moments of crisis, essentially, to be able to drop that in. And I can envision in a tense team environment or even in a relational, you know, personal relational matter, how that would shift the dynamic, how it would get people out of that fear of like what's going to go on. Like giving that hope could completely transform the team dynamic. That's really powerful.
Yeah, imagine when you were talking about that conversation related to the contract that you were in the middle of, when emotions take over, suddenly our brains are wired to deal with the emotions. So everyone's determining, do I need to stay here or run away, right? It's the flight or flight response. And what you really want to be doing is getting back to the material at hand in the conversation of the relationship or the conversation about the contract material. So anyone who has the wherewithal to sort of address or comment on the fact that emotions are okay, but they have no place in taking over what's going on right now, right? That's a way of saying we're attuning to this data signal that this is hard.
Yeah,
but let's place it in its right proportion and get back to caring for the relationship or get back to working on the work at hand.
That's wonderful. One of the things I wanted to open the conversation around was, you know, just given that what I'm hearing is like over 30 years of depth in this field and over 1.5 million people you've surveyed and the work that you've done with the military. Given that we have a military and a veteran audience, is there what things stand out to you? Like, is it either trends that you've seen in this population or things that you'd want them to know or common challenges they face? I wanted to kind of set a wide berth for you to be able to go deeper into audience-specific information.
Sure. Okay. So this is an interesting finding that will be a relief to everyone once they hear it. When we look at trends by profession, it turns out there are only three statistically significant groups of people with higher or lower scores in EQ. The customer service profession does score higher than all other professions. And it's not surprising in that those who are in that field are attending to these social awareness skills all day. So that to be successful in a customer-oriented type of work, that those who are successful are demonstrating higher EQ skills than most other professions. The profession that's significantly lower is engineering. And it may be because those professions are often, you know, working in solo and attending to a different type of data set. And we like to say to people who have low EQ scores, remember, if that first time you assess yourself, you're shocked by how low your score is, it's simply that you've never really attended to this skill and started practicing. So you're really at the beginning of your journey, not at the end. Now, within the engineering profession, there's going to be very high EQ people as very low EQ people. But on the whole, on average, they score a step below other professions to the level that we would call it statistically significant. The third group of people are the chronically unemployed, not those that are temporarily unemployed for a period of a year or a year and a half if they were downsized or making a transition. It's those individuals who are chronically unemployed score lower on EQ, which is interesting. So within that, I have no shocking results for you for our military professionals, right? Mm-hmm. They aren't necessarily higher on social awareness or lower or higher on self-management. Within the profession, I will say that the training for the military profession will increase self-management skills, right? Because as a culture, the military isn't going to allow for freedom of saying and doing whatever you like the way a core team pursuing innovation might push themselves to be, right? So this is back to how we are wired as humans. We're so universally similar in this respect, but on an individual basis, what I need to work on might look very different than what you need to work on.
What I love about that is, well, a couple things. I appreciate when you said that with the engineers that might be discouraged, the sense I got is like, you know, the first time we may have had to do a test involving push-ups or pull-ups of like, you know, if you haven't been training for that, you're not going to do great. And it's not like you throw in the towel, you just realize like, oh, I should probably do some push-ups every day or some pull-ups every day or whatever it is that you're being evaluated on. And as you said earlier, it is a skill that people with practice can improve. It's something that's not fixed. It's something that can grow. And I hope that's really encouraging too for listeners. I was expecting you to say that there was some sort of statistical, because so many hiring managers I've spoken with have said that often the perception of someone in the military is that they are insensitive or things like this. And it sounds like, you know, you pointed out something great, which is that there's perhaps not the freedom of expression in the military compared to maybe a tech startup where there's innovation and there's a lot of relaxed communication. But on the whole, it doesn't seem like there's an extreme deficiency that that our audience needs to be aware of.
Right. I think when they hear those kinds of generalizations, they come from a place that is pointing to a culture clash, not a trait or something about the person. So it could end up being that all of us, as we enter our professions and begin working for different kinds of organizations, we begin to absorb the unspoken rules of the culture that we're working in. Even within one organization, the unspoken rules in one department could be very different than another department. So when we move from job to job, we have to be mindful that we're stepping into a new culture and a new set of unspoken rules. So your social awareness skills become highly important. I'll give you a couple of examples. I did some work over about 3 or 4 years with a multinational organization and flew to Geneva and Shanghai and parts of the US to work with groups of about 50 leaders. And this was easily 5 times a year over the course of 5 years. And time again, I would hear about someone who had been leading a business unit, say, for example, in Europe, who was then assigned to Kenya, right? So they're entering a place in a new business unit in Kenya. And after going through the session where we were working through these skills, they often came to me and said, you know, I realize I made the mistake of coming in the first 3 months with all these kinds of plans and ideas, and I missed the opportunity to really listen in those first few weeks and then meld the ideas that would come forward from the business that I was entering into what my plans were. And it made it more difficult. We wasted a lot of time, and I may have overlooked the importance of investing in those early relationships so that I could draw on getting to know them and build from there. So that's an example of even those people outside of the military, when we make a change from one place to another, is that we're entering a new space and we may have to self-manage and listen more at the early stages. But ultimately, I don't believe that the military skill set does any damage to any new organization. It's really finely tuning how to apply what you bring in the right way at the right time.
I appreciate that aspect too, of realizing that the, for our audience who might be going from military to a civilian career, there's certainly the transition there, but realizing that the process you're undergoing and learning a new culture and those norms and those things, that's the same that occurs within a company from one department to another. As you switch companies or geographic locations, it really underscores the importance of that openness and learning and constantly reevaluating the new environment that one is in. And I also I think I did have kind of a simplistic understanding coming into the conversation, where I was expecting you to say it like, oh, you know, veterans do X, Y, and Z, and that's what to work on. And I think the more nuanced answer that you had was that this is very, very, very individual. All of us have different strengths and weaknesses, and we have different ways that we manifest our emotions and all of these things. So it really is, regardless if someone's in the military or not, it really is a very personal discovery of figuring out one's own inherent settings and how to improve on that. It's not this broad set of criteria that applies to people who've worn a uniform.
Right. Very true. Even think about how you grew up and what occurred at the dinner table in the family you grew up in. Some families consider it a sign of respect to have a healthy debate. And if my dad took me on, then I knew I finally, you know, was interacting with him peer to peer. Well, I may grow up and bring that into a workplace and want to take on someone with a job title higher than mine. And suddenly they're like shocked that I'm being disrespectful, but their conclusion of being disrespectful might come from how they were raised. I'll give you an example. In my family, I come from a Swedish culture, and I'm the youngest of two older brothers, and I'm an introvert. And those three factors really came to fruition in the early days of my career. I had majored in music as a young person, and I knew how to perform in front of audiences, but I had never turned and looked at the audience. When you play an instrument, I played piano, it was myself and the music, but the minute I turned to the audience, I could feel a visceral experience of nerves. I had never realized it, and I think it came from this upbringing of not wanting to take center stage, not wanting to monopolize a conversation, and being able to absorb sort of all of that eye contact for an introvert. But within about, you know, 6 to 8 years of tackling small audiences of 30, and eventually, you know, now, you know, audiences of 350 are just fine for me. And that's a skill set that I had to learn how to be aware of it happening and learn how to breathe, and what I did in the mornings before a particular speaking event. You know, slowly but surely, as you mentioned, I had no public speaking muscle, right? So emotional intelligence skills are a muscle that you have to really build with small steps over time, and it's really accessible to anyone.
That's wonderful. I want to talk about resources. So of course, we'll have a link in the show notes to Emotional Intelligence 2.0. What other resources would you recommend to listeners? And I want to make sure we also cover the three PDFs that your team has available for us.
Sure. Okay. So I will mention a couple resources in the book. And as I mentioned, the 66 strategies, there are between about 15 to 17 strategies for each of these core skills. And they are sequenced by the very beginning skill set strategies up to advanced ones. So if you're someone who's like, I'm really starting out in self-awareness, I'm not even sure I can name the emotions and moods that I experience, you know, there's a strategy or two that will help you along that way. In the back of the book, there's a code that allows you to hop online and take an online assessment. And in that assessment, there are what we call e-learning lessons that allow you to observe a video, to practice your social awareness skills. It sets you up to look for certain things that are occurring and what makes that an insightful part of emotional intelligence. And then afterward, it gives you the analysis or the answer. So if someone who likes private online learning, there's that resource. There's also a free retest that's built in the assessment. So you're able to send yourself a future invite, maybe 9 months later, and it'll ask you to hop online, take the assessment again, and the results report is a change score report. So it'll remind you what you got the first time and what you got the next time, and allow you to sort of begin to identify a new set of strategies that you want to begin working on. So within that book, there's an action plan and everything you need to get started. On our website, it's talentsmart.com, if you do talentsmart.com/articles, there's a library of free downloadable articles. They're short, usually about a page and a half, at most 2 pages, and they're all geared toward how to get you started on practicing something or a key insight about emotional intelligence. So a couple of the documents that I sent to you as an example of one is, what are the 4 signs that you have a low EQ and how to spot what to do about it? And then there's another example article in there, which is a case study that we did on our work with the Air Force. We, for the first time, aligned and partnered with a group of people who were training the advisors in Afghanistan that were preparing the Afghani Air Force. And they brought these emotional intelligence skill sets in to be able to bridge the cultural divide and the language barriers, to be able to instill a climate of respect as the training occurred between the Afghan advisors and the U.S. advisors and the Afghani Air Force. Which is a very interesting story and would help see how EQ is being utilized within the Air Force. I did notice on our articles page, because those are posted about once a week or so, that we have a recent study that my co-author just posted on an interesting set of data being done on using EQ in interviewing in the military, and essentially by screening for and hiring for emotional intelligence skills, they've seen results in lower turnover. So someone might be interested in that. And then we have several free webinars that are also posted on that same article's website that's up at the top right corner. And those would be fun for anyone who'd like to kind of learn more. They can scroll through the topics. You mentioned blogs or other kinds of books, resources that people
anything like, yeah, podcast, movies, puppet shows, anything anything that would help.
I'm a big proponent of movies, being able to watch how people handle emotions. Over a period of time, we've been able to incorporate those somewhat into the online results report of our assessment, so someone might find a couple of these movie clips embedded into their results report so they can have fun with that. There's a recent movie that's in the theaters now that has some interesting scenes. It's the one about Ford versus Ferrari. It's currently in the theaters, and if you haven't seen that movie and you're looking forward to watching it over the holidays, see if you notice the growth and the change of the race car driver in how he handles his emotions and how he uses them for constructive purposes and growth over time in that movie. It's a really fun example, and you'll be practicing your social awareness skills as you do it. There's a podcast called Invisibilia. I don't know if you've heard that term, but they do explore in several sessions about how we handle emotions and how our brain is wired. So that's a fun one to explore, that I would say. For you mentioned Malcolm Gladwell. If there's anyone who's really interested in reading what experts in the field are finding in a way that summarizes it for someone who's not an expert, there's a very interesting book called The Science of Evil. And I think it's named incorrectly. It sounds like a scary book. It's a very small book. It's written by an MD, but the book is really about empathy and how humans are really either other-oriented or have difficulty being other-oriented. And if you're a person who's got difficulties in being other-oriented, you might have more practice than someone who can feel the emotions of someone else. And that book really outlines how to spot when that happens and maybe some things that parents can do with their kids if they find that their child is having difficulties early on in being able to relate to someone else or not understand when if they hurt someone, how that feels to be in someone else's shoes. It's a very interesting.
That's wonderful. For listeners, I'll put links to all of these resources in the show notes, the PDFs. I love the fact that the assessment has the retest. I think that that really reiterates how this is a constant skill that you're developing. And so 9 months, 12 months later, you may have a completely different set of exercises to really work on. I think that's wonderful. I think it's great that you outlined two different articles with the Air Force and then the one about the military hiring. And I think listeners will benefit from those. And then I love this sense of even with movies like the Ford versus Ferrari, just bringing a little bit of awareness of understanding that, of looking for that. And, you know, some actors are incredibly great at showcasing emotions on demand. And so being able to see that and see the impact that that has is another way to make this a little bit more playful.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I think it's helpful to understand when you encounter someone who is considered high EQ, they may have had an advantage in life by having someone to model early on. So as they were sorting through how they dealt with their own emotions, they may have had some type of informal mentor. So for those of us who didn't have that luck in life, that doesn't mean a high EQ is not accessible to you. It simply means you might want to go seek out an EQ mentor. And it occurred to me, we do have an article that is titled How to Choose and Use an EQ Mentor. Just someone in your life that you approach and ask to mentor you, and it outlines how to utilize their expertise, how to utilize their time, how to set up those kinds of conversations with them.
That's great. I'll find that article and link to it in the show notes as well. I know that we've only got a few minutes left here. So two last questions. Last question is just going to be a catch-all for anything we didn't cover. But you just kind of touched on the whole thought of parenting, and it made me kind of view this differently. And I'm wondering, I have a 9 month or 10 month old son, and many of our listeners I know have kids as well, or will one day. Anything pertinent just to that thought of like how to parent a child to have that emotional intelligence? I'm sure, you know, some element of that is just having that ourselves so we can demonstrate that, but anything in particular about how to gift that to our children?
Sure. I think for the young ones, it's being able to give them a language over time, help them find words to share what they feel. Now that might not start till 5 or 6 or 7, but to help them name what they're feeling is quite a gift. I had an early experience in training young directors that had high degrees in biology at a dialysis company, really brilliant science kind of professionals. And a young woman came up to me and she said, "Science was so valued in my family. What you're saying, I literally don't know if I can name my feelings." So it's, again, not too late for her, but she was in her early 30s as she's starting this journey for herself because it wasn't valued and she was never asked to notice. And she's a data person. Imagine she missed this whole data set. So for young children, it's helping them find a name for what they feel. And as they grow, having them feel okay to have a range of feelings, that these negative emotions aren't bad and should be stuffed and put away. So to have them, but they can still be held accountable for behavior that's appropriate. And maybe talking out loud about how they might think someone else might feel. Those are the early origins of helping them begin to even recognize that something like empathy has a role in the world and that could be a useful skill later in their work life. So those three things I think are very helpful. I'll share one last story that you'll find interesting. I heard an interview with Anderson Cooper about his mother. She was Gloria Vanderbilt, a well-known socialite, and he has memories of her as a child where she would throw very large parties at the home that he grew up in, and he was upstairs as maybe a 7 or an 8 year old, and he would tiptoe down the steps and sit halfway down and just kind of watch what was going on. And he said that when she noticed him, she would call him over and say, come join me. And then as she was, you know, maneuvering through this party, as you might imagine, she had quite sophisticated social skills, she would lean over and say to him, do you notice so-and-so over there? They're upset because of, you know, the banquet wasn't here early enough. Or do you see what's happening over there? That is a parent handing off emotional intelligence skills to their child as they're growing up. And he's just absorbing it along the way without feeling like he's going to some class.
That's great. I mean, that makes me think of the mentorship point that you had made earlier. Like he had that built-in mentor. Yes. And I love that. I love that sense of showing kids that there aren't good or bad emotions and they are still held accountable. I think that that's really wonderful as well. I can relate to what that scientist friend had said. I did work with Marshall Rosenberg's nonviolent communication. And that was the first exposure for me. I remember I had like a little sheet of paper with like a list of feelings. And it was like, oh, I know anger and sadness. I know like the basic ones, but the subtler textures of these ones were really inaccessible to me for a while. And like you said, it's just practicing. And I could see with children how that could be like being able to give them those nuances and help them name that. And I particularly like what you were saying about helping them imagine what someone else might be feeling. Like that seems like a really wonderful exercise to help them gain that empathy or start to view things from someone else's perspective.
Right. And I think as parents, we often think we have to have all the answers or to be perfect. But if we come home after a difficult day at work, and now we have a 12-year-old or a 15-year-old in our home, it's certainly appropriate to say, you know, I had a really rough day at work. If I feel a little on edge, I want you to know it's not you. Because by the time our teenagers have lived with us this long, they have this fine-tuned radar of when to avoid you or when not. And they will also inadvertently conclude that what you're feeling has something to do with what they've said and done to you. And that's where their gut feelings are wrong, because they're going to think that you're disappointed in them when in fact it was something that happened at work that day, right? Mm-hmm. So it's okay to model for them these ups and downs in life, and to say, you know, I would love to hear from you how I come across when I'm stressed, and have your teenager tell you. That not only tells them that you're still learning and want to be aware, that tells them that it's okay for them to figure out how they operate when they're stressed.
That's wonderful. Well, I always like to leave the last question open-ended, and you can take it either as, you know, we've covered so much ground. Yes. I'm sure there's things that you wanted to talk about that we didn't talk to, so I'd love to make space for that. Or just what are some final words of wisdom that you'd like to leave listeners with?
Well, maybe I should wrap up, because as we, you know, touch base on all these different types of topics, the takeaways I would hope is that this skill set is learnable. It's learnable within 6 to 9 months of repeated practice on very specific strategies. It doesn't mean you'll master the entire skill set in 9 months, but if you want to learn, say, for example, how not to interrupt everybody so much, there's a couple of strategies in there to how to practice that. Give that one narrow thing a shot at 4, 5, 6, 9 months of practice, and then move on to the next one. Give yourself permission to take a while as you start your journey. Think about your work day or your school day as this gym where you can exercise this muscle with each new person that you encounter. Don't ever consider an interaction as failed, because you can loop back around and give it a second try. Someone who has received, you know, the brunt of one of your lowest EQ moments, they will be happy to receive an I'm sorry, and can I share a little bit about what was going on with me when I did that, and then you get started in a new path. And so that's really kind of my hope for everyone. We've been so pleased with the work with the Air National Guard, with the Air Force. We see a real connection with resilience, which we also know has been valued by the military profession. So for people who are interested in knowing where there's a connection, we see these skills as being able to kind of support people. And the last part that I will say that might be new is there's such a role in the negative self-talk that occurs inside our minds. And I'll give you last one example. For someone who's working overseas and they're calling home and they don't reach their girlfriend or their boyfriend or their spouse, their negative self-talk might say, you know, who are they with? Or, you know, why aren't they there for me? And then the worry starts to kind of create a distance, when in fact your self-talk could be replaced with something along the lines of, yeah, they may be at the grocery store. I think when I finally circle back in with them, I'll ask, hey, you know, where were you? Right? So be attuned to what thoughts are going through your mind and how that contributes to your sense of you know, reassurance or confidence in your relationships.
This is wonderful. Well, thank you for taking the time to speak with us. Thank you for the work you're doing. I know that listeners, this can impact their professional lives, their personal lives, their parenting. There's so much that this impacts. And so I appreciate just the your life's work that you've contributed to the world, but also for taking time out of your schedule to do a deeper dive with our audience. And it means a lot.
Yeah, it's been my pleasure. Surface.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Quick couple admin points. We release brand new episodes every single Monday and Thursday. Those are usually recorded about a month or so before they go live. Every Monday and Thursday, we have an interview, usually almost always with a military veteran about their civilian career. More and more, we're starting to add in experts who may not be veterans, but may have some expertise that will help the military veteran community. Saturdays, I typically post more of a behind the scenes episode, which is a free form format. I try to use what I'm calling a mullet format. And by that, I mean business up front, party in the back, talking through admin points, professional topics related to the podcast. It might be a conversation I had that week. It might have been an interview I had that week, but just trying to share things that are top of mind that may help you, and more of a free form, straight from the heart format. And then the party in the back is the personal side of things, just kind of more free flowing thoughts on life, on improving oneself, just kind of whatever's going on in life and trying to be authentic and honest about those things as well. Special thanks. We have an all volunteer army of people behind Beyond the Uniform making this possible. We do this on our lunch breaks, on our evenings, on our weekends, because we love the military community. We want to give back. We want to make a difference. We want that as part of the purpose in our life that we valued in the military. So special thanks to Steve Bain. Steve does pretty much everything. He helps secure guests. He does our newsletter. He keeps the reels rolling and keeps me sane. Kathleen Dillon, the first person to join our team. She writes text transcripts of every single episode. It's wild. She keeps up with two of these a week despite a demanding career and education right now. But those transcripts help us get more SEO value, helps her audience more. Andrew Woolridge is our data guru. He helps us understand the numbers, which is the easiest way for us to figure out how we can better support you, and adds kind of the data oversight for that. Rick Healy does all of our social media. He is gaining more and more of an audience for us by getting our videos, getting our podcasts out on social channels. The best way to stay in contact with us is if you go to beyondtheuniform.org, there is a newsletter. You'll have a little pop-up that comes up. You can put your email in. We email twice per month. We try to be respectful, but it is a great way to get appraised of upcoming events, upcoming interviews, promos where companies are giving discounts to Beyond the Uniform listeners, and more. This does cost money to put on. We are committed to not charging veterans directly. And the way that we kind of offset costs is through corporate sponsors. So if you know of a company that would like to get in front of a military audience and their families, that's one way that we can both add value to our members, but also offset the costs of Beyond the Uniform and give us a little bit of budget to start expanding what we're doing. So that's the best way you can help us. If that's not something that you can do, a positive review on iTunes is greatly appreciated. Have a wonderful week. We will be back Monday, Thursday, and Saturday with more interviews. And keep up the listening. Take care.